Hello and a very warm welcome to On Design. It's the show brought to you by the team behind Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Now each week we play around, plunder and talk through an aspect of design that we think deserves just that little bit more attention. From overlooked practitioners to typography, architectural triumphs and almost everything in between. With the Winter Olympics well underway in Pyeongchang, this week sports writer and journalist David Goldblatt tells us why there's much more to the Olympics than the famous rings, designed by the co-founder of the modern games, Baron Pierre de Coubertin, though they're an extremely good place to start.
The Olympic rings make their first appearance at Antwerp in 1920, so we've got 24 years of the Olympic movement without a logo and without the icon. And from what we can see from the scattered notes of de Coubertin, who is amongst the most unreliable correspondents on these things, he dreamt it up and worked on it through the First World War and debuted it at Antwerp. And two stories have kind of come down to us, neither necessarily true, one of which is that the five rings each represent a continent. I think that's the least likely. But also the idea that the five colours can be found in any flag. At least one of those colours can be found in every flag of every member of the IOC. Whether there's truth in it or not, it's an incredibly good logo. It's unmistakable. It's totally memorable. It's got feelings of unity and connectedness and solidarity, the linking of rings, without being oppressive or fascist or a sort of sense of overweening power. So in that regard, de Coubertin came up brilliantly. It was a brilliant innovation. I think it's worth remembering that it was debuted at Antwerp 1920 as part of a wider set of changes, which were de Coubertin's attempt to bring a sense of ritual and grandeur to the games that he felt had often been absent or underplayed in the years before the First World War, and to give, of course, the International Olympic movement a public and visible identity. And so alongside the rings at 1920, we also have the first athlete's oath, for example. And we have the singing of the Olympic hymn as well.
In the name of all the competitors, I promise that we shall take part in the Olympic Games, respecting and abiding by the rules which govern them, committing ourselves to a sport without doping and without drugs, in the true spirit of sportsmanship, for the glory of the sport and the honour of our teams.
And this is a response in part of the competition that the Olympics is facing from commercial sport and from other ways of performing and organising the sporting spectacular. One interesting story is that in the 1930s, a baker in Culver City in Los Angeles called Paul Helms, who was quite an Olympic enthusiast, copyrighted the Olympic rings in every state in the United States and at a federal level. And this is before the Olympic movement had any idea of what intellectual property rights were. He kept that copyright, I believe, for 20 years until he returned it to the IOC after the Second World War. He made a fortune with his Olympic bread, aerated industrial bread delivered to the new suburbs of Los Angeles with a fabulous neon Olympic ring above his bakery, which is still there.
Everybody's favorite, the guy who blew the whistle, the helmsman.
I think really for, you know, actually bringing a sense of design of which logos are a part, the key Olympic Games in 1968 and 1972, Mexico and Munich. And Mexico in particular, you know, they employ Lance Wyman, a young US graphic designer, to come up with a set of imagery and typography that will present a modern Mexico rather than, as they would say, the land of mañana, the stereotyped image of a backward, antiquated agrarian society. And so Mexico 68 has the most extraordinary logo and typography, which is part Bridget Riley pop art, black and white kind of stripes and symbols, and part indigenous, a reworking of various kinds of indigenous art that Wyman found when he went to Mexico. And alongside this, an incredible use of colour in all the ticketing, signage, the pictograms. There had been nothing like it. That's really where the trend begins. The first mascot is at Grenoble in 1968, unofficially, but the first actual mascot is at Munich 72. Munich 72 is remembered as the most designed Olympics in some way by Otti Ashler, the great post-war West German designer, who really envisaged that design at the Olympics was a way of saying, this is not Berlin 36, this is not Nazi Germany. Don't just hear it from us, don't believe it, look and see in the way in which we have designed it. And so you have not a trace of the black and the red and the gold and the crimson of Berlin 1936 or its kind of Gothic typeface, but, you know, clean, open, transparent, ethereal blues and silvers, unserifed and incredibly open typefaces. And alongside this, tragically, the first actual official mascot, which was a ridiculous blue foam dachshund, which has started, I'm afraid to say, a terrible tradition of Olympic mascots. With Mexico 68 and Munich 72, you really have got designers working at the height of their game with a really interesting and distinctive aesthetic vision, whatever you think of the politics of those games. What's come subsequently has been increasingly run to, you know, PR consultancies rather than actually inspired design visions. I mean, when was the last time you thought design at the Olympics was good?
Antiperspirant, helping you stay dry and confident, is a proud sponsor of the United States Olympic team.
The history of sportswear sponsorship at the Olympics goes back a long way. Adidas and Puma, back in 1960 at Rome, were fighting over the West German sprint team as to which shoes would they wear, with designs deliberately thought about how will this look on television, how will this be picked out. So while particularly in the era of faux amateurism, which is the 1960s and 1970s, athletes are increasingly relying on this kind of, in effect, sponsorship and branding. And as far as, you know, by the time you get to 1968, Adidas actually has a shop at the Mexico City Olympic Village, and they are handing out free kit and above all free shoes to any athlete that wants them. So that kind of guerrilla marketing, in effect, taking advantage without actually putting an advert up, is now, what, half a century old. The people who sponsor the timing and the electronics also get their logo in the stadium in the way that actually many of the advertisers don't, because there aren't conventional advertising holdings for sponsors in the way that you have at the World Cup, for example. I mean, what's so remarkable about the Olympics is not so, and its advertising is less in a way what goes on inside the stadium or immediately in front of the cameras, but the absolutely gigantic budgets that the sponsors use, as they would say, to activate it. Many, many, many times over, the money that they pay to the Olympic movement is spent actually activating that sponsorship in 100 different ways in the Olympic City, but also across global media networks.
Our very special thanks to David Goldblatt for that report. David has written A Global History of the Olympics entitled The Games, published by WW Norton & Company. You've been listening to On Design, a Monocle 24 production from the team behind Section D. You can listen to the full half-hour show on Tuesdays at 1900 London time or download the podcast at any time you like. And remember, if you can't wait, there are always more delights to uncover in the pages of Monocle magazine. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye. Thank you.